Choke Points, brought to you by Acton's Quality Roofing. This, we hope, will not have the same impact as the recent closure of westbound I-90 over the weekend, but a big change is about to happen on I-90 east of Snoqualmie Pass. Here's Chris.
And westbound I-90 drivers have been watching the preparations for this change for months. It's been hard to miss the new two-lane stretch of freeway that's been carved into what used to be rocks, dirt, and trees down the Easton Hill. The new lanes are next to the existing westbound lane, separated by a Jersey barrier. The road then peels away from the westbound lane, snakes its way back over to the eastbound direction at the bottom of the hill. The Washington Department of Transportation's Summer Derry says cars will be sharing that stretch of road pretty quickly.
So we're going to move the eastbound lanes over the westbound side here pretty soon, likely early next week. And so that'll be a 2-mile traffic shift through that area. And that'll be in effect probably for a couple of years as we make way for those added lanes.
WashDOT is widening 6 more miles of I-90 to go with the 8 miles it already expanded from Snoqualmie Pass. Derry says it shouldn't be too big of a deal for issue for drivers, but driving in an oncoming direction of the freeway, even with a Jersey barrier separating you, can be a little unnerving.
I think it'll be pretty basic. Just follow the detour signs, reduce speeds to the work zone, just a traffic shift around the work zone. Really need to slow down and be extra careful in that section. Certainly during the winter, we're going to have extra maintenance crews out there patrolling.
And this shift will likely be in place for 4 or 5 years.
The reason why we're shifting traffic off this area is that we can work quicker, for sure. But that's a lot of lane miles, you know, 6 lanes total in each direction.
With only about half the year available for construction because of the weather. This is the third phase of the widening project from Snoqualmie Pass to Cle Elum. And Derry says it also includes another key feature.
We are going to add another wildlife overcrossing up the top of the hill more toward that eastern area. And so you're not going to see that being constructed until at least maybe 2026.
Now, what's odd about this particular project is that the widening will not begin right where the previous widening ended. It's not going to begin right there where I-90 goes from 3 lanes down to 2, just east of that first wildlife crossing. It's actually starting about 2 miles away, leaving a gap where the road will go from 3 lanes in each direction to 2 and then back to 3. And the reason for that is kind of interesting. There's a lot more environmental issues and concerns along that particular 2-mile stretch of I-90, which requires a lot more study and a lot more environmental permitting. And so WashDOT didn't want to wait for that, so it's jumping ahead a few miles to work on what it can, and then it will finish the gap later. So that's coming up, and that big lane shift should be coming sometime next week, and I'm looking forward to driving it because I will be next week.
Well, you're a frequent I-90 flyer, so is that going to make a difference given that you're not going to have all those lanes all the way through?
What it will do eventually, I mean, we're talking 5 or 6 years down the road when the construction's done. What it does now for the drivers is you're going to get up to the hill and you're used to just going straight down. Now you're going to have to jog into the other lane of traffic, and it's just going to be kind of an unnerving switch for you, especially in the winter because the lanes are going to be tighter. There's just a Jersey barrier between you, so it's just something to be aware of that's coming up, and hopefully before the snow starts, people will get a pretty good idea of what it's like to drive it.
Something spooky is happening on some American Airlines flights. Here's Cairo News Radio's Lisa Brooks.
It's not even Halloween, but multiple American Airlines flights have been experiencing something very strange on the overhead PA system. Those sounds captured by film producer Emerson Collins and posted on TikTok. He says it started over the intercom before takeoff and continued throughout the flight. Sounds like somebody was playing a joke and got a hold of a microphone somewhere, but the airline says that's not the case. After Collins' post went viral, others reported hearing similar sounds on American flights. With no clear explanation. American Airlines says it was caused by a mechanical problem, but so far that's all they'll say. In the meantime, I'm Lisa Brooks, Cairo News Radio.
It sounds like the airplane has achieved sentience and is complaining about its conditions.
What? You know, we had an HVAC upgrade here a few years ago, and everybody remembers Frank Shires. He was here for years, and so he would work alone overnights, and he got really scared because the sound coming from the new HVAC was like, ooh.
Yeah, there was a ghost in the building. Yeah, it sounded just like that.
And then we all heard it as the day goes on and they fixed it, but it sounded legitimately like a ghost. This sounds like somebody with indigestion.
Or a goat somehow is lost up in the wiring.
The thing is, an airplane is a confined space. How difficult could this be to find?
I don't know. I think shenanigans is happening.
No, they said it started before flight.
It starts too, before flight.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there's some shenanigans going on, and they're trying to figure it out before they tell passengers, but that sounds nothing like a mechanical issue.
Well, if anybody has any clues, we have a lot of very talented airplane engineers in this area.
Yes.
Someone must know what's going on.
My neighbor is a pilot, too. I might ask. Okay.
It is budget season, and King County Executive Dow Constantine and other local leaders are rolling out a new proposal to address one of the region's biggest problems, that being the behavioral health crisis. And this comes with a big ask, as in money. Here's Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott to tell us all about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Dave. Is homelessness, open-air drug use, people in clear mental health crisis, random assaults, and worse? If you've been in Seattle area for even a day, you've probably seen all or most of that already. Local leaders have tried and failed for years to get a handle on the behavioral health crisis in the region. Behavioral health, by the way, does refer to mental health as well as substance abuse disorder. Now there's a new proposal on the table that was detailed by King County Executive Dale Constantine yesterday.
To improve public safety, to free up scarce emergency room beds, to get people out of homelessness, we must invest in behavioral health. These challenges are distinct from one another, but they are interconnected.
Now, this proposal, as you mentioned, Dave, does come with a big ask of taxpayers.
I will transmit to the King County Council a proposal for a new crisis care centers levy. The rate would be 14.5 cents per $1,000 of assessed value, or about $10 per month for the median priced home, which is around $800,000 in King County.
So roughly about $121 a year added to that median price home on your property tax bill, which, remember, is already pretty high here in King County. Constantine calls this an opportunity, though, for a generational investment.
The Crisis Care Center's levy would invest nearly $1.25 billion over 9 years in turning the tide on the behavioral health crisis that is impacting every community in our county.
So exactly where will that money go?
So here's the first part, the centerpiece of what we propose. A new regional network of 5 crisis centers located throughout the county. The second major part of our proposal, we will stop the loss of residential beds. And not only that, we will replace what has already been lost. The third major part of our proposal, we will invest in livable wages and the work to attract and train and retain a bigger and more representative behavioral health workforce.
And just to kind of elaborate on that, there's been an enormous loss of trained behavioral health workers over the last couple of years here in the state, in the county, and as well as the beds, the residential beds that he's talking about.
So it's not just the buildings that are the problem. It's getting people who want to work in that field for the money they're willing to pay.
It's almost an equal crisis. Absolutely. And at the same time, you know, so the crisis centers he's talking about, that actually plays in a little bit to that new 988 system that we've talked about before, where they want to create these types of places where you can, it's basically an urgent care if you're in a mental health crisis or a drug addiction crisis of some sort, whatever it might be. You can walk in, or your family member, whatever it is, can take you there, because right now there's one, it's the Downtown Services Center, but you have to have a referral, right, from a cop or a mobile Health One unit or somebody like that.
So this would be walk-in service
where they can, there's some short-term stay availability in these facilities. There's also, and then they can refer you out to, depending on what your situation might be, but regardless of your insurance situation, you can get the care that you need right then when you walk in. And that is a critical piece of this. That's what's working in places like Arizona and some other states where some of our lawmakers recently went and visited. So why should you care about this?
Improving our behavioral health crisis system benefits many other parts of our community and society. Emergency rooms, jails, schools, first responders, shelters, supportive housing, and even or especially families struggle when we allow our behavioral health system to fall behind.
And it's truth. I mean, I can speak to that even with, he mentioned yesterday about how there's, you know, there's no room at Western State, right? Yeah. A lot of these folks end up in the jail. Even when, back when my grandmother was alive, when she started losing her faculties, right? So we ended up having to put her in a nursing home, but she ended up being in a hospital for 2 months because wow. there was no room at any of the nursing homes. Thankfully, this was before the pandemic. But I remember going, she had a competency hearing, and it was, we went twice. They had to strap her into the ambulance, take her down there, and then they didn't even have time to get to the hearing. It was a mess. This whole system is really, really broken in this state. Another critical piece I want to hit quickly that was I was really glad to hear as a part of this investment.
So the final component of this proposal includes funding to quickly expand mobile or site-based crisis behavioral health services that can operate even before the first crisis care centers open. Inaction is not an option. We're losing facilities and workforce at the exact moment that mental health and substance use disorder crises are growing.
So what he's talking about there, because they're going to build these, right, just from the from scratch, these yeah. crisis care facilities at various points around the county. So they're going to expand immediately the mobile units that we have right now. We have a couple of them out there right now. I didn't get an exact number on how many, but that's a very big deal.
So there could be additional capacity right away?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
It's close, very close to right away, yes. So I want to point out, this would be on the next April ballot if the county council approves it, right? So first you need the county council to sign off, then it would go to the voters and they would have to approve it next April. The first time you would have to pay the taxes 2024, it lasts through 2032.
So let me ask the question I always ask you every time you're in here.
Yeah.
What difference will people see on the streets?
I would love to be able to give you my crystal ball and tell you that you would see a difference. I can tell you that this is a very Here's the bottom line. There is not, I have been saying it for years, there is not enough money being put into the mental health, behavioral health needs of this state. That's always been the case. There needs to be more from the federal level, all the way up top. We need more from the state as well. But the county coming together, there was a lot of other regional leaders, different cities from in King County that were part of this yesterday as well. To have them come at this collaboratively is a very, very good thing, I think. I think this can make a difference, but I've thought that in the past, so I hesitate to make any promises.
And taxpayers are saying, well, why can't you just shift the money you're already getting, because you already pay pretty high taxes, from things that we don't need so much to this, which we do need?
Well, and that's the argument, right? There's a lot of money. There's a lot of money going to things that perhaps not everybody is on board with, you know, there's not everybody is in love with the various, you know, diversion programs that we have. Not everybody's in love with the various help for low-income people, all of these types of things. They have issue with a lot of.
I think people are for it if it works, but I mean, we've had a history of announcing all these new initiatives, and yet you still see the tents, you still see the drug dealing, you still see the people in crisis walking through the parks.
Our new collaborative homeless agency, right? Our regional homeless authority. There's not a lot of visible difference there yet. That's still getting up and running. This is a different thing. Any money that can be put into the behavioral health space is an important thing, I think. So if you're going to spend money on something, and here's the bottom line, people, there is not enough money in because of our tax structure and all of that. I'm not taking a side one way or the other on that, but the money isn't there to make the investments that's necessary to make a visible difference on the street. That's just a fact. So if you want to start seeing something different happen and start seeing a visible difference, you're going to have to put some pony up. You're going to have to put some of your money up.
Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Have you seen what's going on in the real world?
Oh, man.
There's your answer, Dave.
Maybe that's it.
Woo! Well, let me introduce you to the world of kindness. Yes, it exists. Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Baird. It's often said there's nothing stronger than the love of a mom, but how about the love of two moms? CBS's Steve Hartman with the story.
Just outside Salt Lake City, 46-year-old Shauna Austin is about to let you in on a secret.
I've never talked about it, ever.
When Shauna was 20 and single, she got pregnant. Says she wasn't ready to be a mom, so she made the decision to place her baby for adoption. It wasn't easy.
Do you remember holding him the first time?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What was that like?
He was perfect. And I knew I would have him for a short time. So I made every minute count with him.
She called the boy Riley and says she held him for 72 hours straight until the time came to let go. Her Riley was now somebody else's Stephen. And at this point, like with most closed adoptions, a firewall went up between Shauna and Stephen's new parents. No communication whatsoever. And this went on for about a week.
It was like, okay, this is the way it should be. She is part of our family.
Adoptive parents Jennifer and Chris Schobinger say they had no interest in excluding the birth mother.
You know, you can't have too many people loving you, right? Why couldn't he be both of ours?
So, year after year, they sent Shauna piles of pictures and these bound books detailing Stephen's every major and minor milestone, like this complete list of his vocabulary. All so that when Shauna was ready and Stephen was ready, they could pick up right where they left off. The two reunited when Stephen was 7. Shauna taught him how to fish, and they have been reeling in the memories ever since.
I was blessed beyond words.
I kind of got best of both worlds for sure.
Stephen is now 26, married with a brand new boy of his own, much to the delight of Grandma Shauna.
That was really special. It just brought that full circle around.
Especially when she heard the baby's name. Riley.
Oh.
Felt like that name was just supposed to be in the family.
I think the lesson we've learned is that sometimes we create barriers where barriers don't need to be. And when we pull down those barriers, we really find love on the other side.
Words of wisdom to help us all live the life of Riley.
Oh my gosh, he's so cute.
Steve Hartman, On the Road, in Lehi, Utah.
Did you hear her at the end go, oh my gosh. So one more reason not to join the metaverse. You can't smell a baby's head in the metaverse.
7:49 now. Visiting us from the Gian Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock. Here's G. Scott.
Morning,
so
brother.
You're familiar with the timeline we're talking about here. Apple has made a Will Smith movie. This is considered Oscar bait. They want to win an Oscar with this. But then, of course, Will Smith slapped Chris Rock at the Academy Awards, and now he's banned from the Academy. So if his movie were to be released and were to win an Oscar, he couldn't accept it. And so Apple is now trying to decide what to do with its Will Smith movie.
Right.
And so I raise the question, so how, what's the, you know, what's the sentence for a slap at the Oscars, and how long does the cooling off period have?
Well, Will Smith reset his clock, and Will Smith can't get out of Will Smith's way. And let me explain. First of all, he had an opportunity at the Oscars when it was time for him to get his, when he accepted his award, accepted his Oscar, he could have apologized to Chris Rock right then. He had that opportunity. He didn't do it. Then at the after parties in which he went to, in which he brought his Oscar with him,
he's partying hard
and having fun, and hey, I'm Will Smith and get jiggy with it and all that stuff, right? You had your opportunity to apologize then. You didn't do it. Your children are on social media trying to, yeah, that's how we do things, saying all those things. So that was in April. And then you kind of went away. You didn't say anything for some time. You haven't said anything. And when you finally come back to say something, it is in this unorganic video, an apology video to Chris Rock that you do on YouTube.
In which he never said, I'm sorry.
In which you never said you're sorry. Thank you, Colleen. So then you did that. And then the rest of the world's like, go away, Will Smith. You messed that up. So now he kind of goes away and he makes little things on social media to kind of test the waters to see if he's still liked. And people are like, no, we still don't like you, Will. He's gone away. Instead, there needs to be someone that is in his corner that says, Will, bro, you messed up.
Isn't that supposed to be his wife?
I don't know.
I mean, really, when you have a partner, aren't they supposed to be the ones that rein you in and go, hey, you made a mistake?
Well, do we always go to our spouses for every piece of advice?
Well, but she was the target, right? The one that he was defending.
Yes. But I don't know that Jada is the one to kind of help him in this. I think he needs a professional publicist to come in and be Will Smith damage control. The first thing you need to do is tell the world, I messed up so bad, I need anger management help, okay? Also, while I'm doing this anger management help, I want to find out other organizations that are doing the work to help people with my problem. I want to donate money to that. I want to go and work with these people. I want to have a panel where I have other professionals sit on down. I want to tell the world that I really messed up by slapping a man in front of the world on stage.
And all proceeds from my movie will go to an alopecia cure or whatever it is, you know, like...
Come on now.
You see how we're rolling?
Yeah. Do that, and then Apple can come out and say, oh, yeah, we got this Will Smith movie that we're sitting on. But Apple can't do anything because Apple has a Will Smith problem.
What is this? Oh, it's called Emancipation. It's about a freed slave who joins the Union Army. I mean, that's an important story to tell.
It really is. Mm. But it is one that will flop. Because nobody is going to care.
Or this is Apple floating a trial balloon, getting you hyped, going, oh, there's a Will Smith. Oh, it's called Emancipation. Oh, maybe I should watch it and see how I feel about Will because I'm watching it. I mean, I always think that.
No, you're right. Maybe Apple admitted it. First of all, we didn't know about this until Apple let it be known. Like, hey, just so you know, we're sitting on this. Or it's like, I kind of, hey, Dave Ross. I've done this before, by the way. Hey, Dave, what do you think about these shoes I'm going to wear? And Dave's like, well. And so it's kind of a teaser test.
Could the movie be the redemption? If they sort of release it, don't release it online or something. Maybe even, you know, release it free.
Yeah.
And people love it. That's the role that redeems him.
No.
No?
No.
I think social...
If they gave you an Apple TV subscription for a month so you could watch it, would you be like, all right.
I think that us right here... I think that we are in the minority of how media is consumed. And what's really rocking the world right now, I know you guys, you know I'm going to say it. Yes, YouTube, TikTok, all of the social media, these youngsters, our children, they don't consume media the way that we do. The things that we thought or think are cool, they don't do anymore. So the Will Smith... And this movie has a Will Smith problem. And so until Will Smith comes out and wants to tell the world that, hey, you know what? I really messed up. And it's a genuine apology. And by the way, Chris Rock keeps playing a game like, nope, nope. I'm going to keep going on tour. And every time I'm going to make a joke talking about how you came up on stage and slapped me, I'm going to milk this for a long time. Hey, sure. Will, I'm going to start getting $25 million a movie.
There you go.
G. Scott, 9 o'clock. Thank you, G. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And joining us now, as he does on Tuesdays, is David Farenthold from the New York Times, whose specialty is to hold charities accountable. And you've got two stories in the Times today, which read like a couple of episodes of Nonprofits Run Wild. We'll get to Herschel Walker in a moment, but let's begin with this, the pandemic aid fraud out of Minnesota. What happened there?
It's just such a huge fraud. So basically what happened was there were these programs that the government used during the pandemic to try to feed hungry kids. They poured lots and lots of money into programs meant to give meals to children who were hungry and out of school, so they couldn't even get meals through school. And what happened allegedly was that these folks in Minnesota, a huge conspiracy of them, at least 49 so far, combined to fake kids. They would claim to be feeding kids, make up names, make up ages, and then submit their claims to the state, and the state would pay them as if they were feeding real children. They took advantage of the fact that during the pandemic there was a lot more money available and a lot less oversight from the state. And so they got more than $240 million, the federal prosecutors say, in just like 18 months just by lying about the kids they were feeding.
That's crazy. And they also got some help from a couple of internet websites, which I didn't realize existed, including one called listofrandomnames.com.
Yeah, this just shows you how little they were trying to cover their tracks, allegedly. So in one case, you know, they had to submit these rosters of kids they said they were feeding. And one of the rosters, the names were all hyperlinked to, yes, a website called listofrandomnames.com. What's more than that, they would use – they had to give the ages of these kids. And instead of going to the trouble of putting in a different age for every kid, they just used an Excel program that randomized the numbers between 7 and 17. But the problem with that was that it kept randomizing them so that every month they would submit the same list of kids, but their ages would all be different. You know, today Timmy would be 5. Next week he'd be 10. Then he'd be 9 again. It was so blatant, but the system that depended on some nonprofits – that's why I got involved – the system depended on a nonprofit to be the watchdog of these groups, and instead, allegedly, the nonprofit went bad and started working to conceal their fraud.
Okay, now how did you catch on to this fraud?
I wish I could brag that I figured it out before anybody else did, but instead, the FBI raided a bunch of these places in January, right after I started on the nonprofit beat, and so I thought, well, you know, this looks big. I better go figure out what went wrong.
Okay, did nobody at the state check to see that these meals were actually being distributed?
That's kind of a mixed answer. So they went under the pandemic, the new rules that Congress set during the pandemic, they didn't have to go out to the sites to see the meals were being administered. So, you know, if you claim to be feeding 5,000 kids out of a second story apartment, they would just take your word for it. That said, the state could have done a lot more. In the end, what they did was, after months of this and seeing the huge expansion of funding going to this one set of groups, they started giving a little more scrutiny to the groups. Not stopping them, but, you know, when they applied for new sites, they started giving a little more scrutiny. And what happened was the nonprofit that was sort of the umbrella group for the fraud sued them and said, we serve mainly East African immigrants. You're slowing down our operation to feed those people. Because of you, children are starving, and you're also acting out of racial bias and racial animus.
So they worked. They tried to use race as an immunity idol, basically.
They did, and it worked. I mean, the state said, look, you know, you have not – the judge said, I'm sorry, the state had not done enough to sort of slow these permits down, and it needed to keep approving them. So instead, the state officials sort of throw up their hands and go to the FBI. But, you know, that program that eventually worked, but it meant that there were like 7 or 8 months where the FBI was investigating, and the state was still paying out millions of dollars a week to these people that they already suspected of being frauds.
Yeah. And now some of these defendants have skipped the country.
Some of them have, and some of them have been trying to. In the last, since the big announcement, which was last week, two new people, including one yesterday that hadn't been charged yet, but apparently were part of the same conspiracy, made plane reservations to leave Minneapolis and fly to overseas, one to Ethiopia and one to Turkey. And when the FBI got wind of those plans, it arrested them before they could leave.
Wow. Has Minnesota put in place anything that can stop this kind of thing from happening in the future?
Well, it's gotten a lot easier now that the pandemic is over for everybody, including Minnesota. But yes, Minnesota, I don't think they have done that much other than shut off funding to this one group, obviously. But they've come under a lot of criticism from Republicans in their state. It's a Democratic administration that runs Minnesota. Republicans there have said, you know, look, you know, Minnesota had a kind of fraud that nobody else had. It must be in part that we are not doing as good of a job in scrutinizing these folks. So they're still under a lot of pressure to get better.
Yeah. It's really insidious, though, when, you know, do-gooders become do-batters. And they do it so blatantly.
That's right. This system is constructed so that these nonprofits have so much power to do evil if they want it. And in this case, the pandemic multiplied that by a number of times. But you're right. That using their nonprofit status and then also using the cloak of serving a disadvantaged racial group, serving immigrants, using that as a shield from scrutiny, certainly worked in their favor and allowed this fraud to get a lot bigger.
And then there's the case of Herschel Walker, who's running as the Republican candidate for Senate in Georgia and also has a charity food program. And you started trying to find out where those charity contributions were going. And apparently you had a tough time tracking the money.
This was such an echo of covering Trump in 2016. So Herschel Walker runs a food distribution business. Basically, he sells like chicken wings and hamburgers and other things in bulk to restaurants. And he has said, going back to like 2007, that his company gives away a percentage of its profits. Sometimes he set up to 15% of its profits to charities. And he usually lists four charities that get the money. So all we did was call those four charities and say, hey, did you ever get money from Herschel Walker? And the answer will surprise you. No. One of them wouldn't comment. Two said they'd never gotten any money from Walker. And the other one said, well, we got a gift from him for $25 in 2009. And then nothing since then. So, you know, this he's made this promise. He lived on that promise, you know, talked about it in his speeches for so long. And we couldn't find any evidence it was true.
But what you did find evidence of was the charities were paying money to him.
Yeah, there's very well documented flow of money from charities to Herschel Walker. Just since March, charities have paid him $115,000 to give speeches, you know, to come to their events and give speeches. And some of them, in one case, he got like $65,000 from a place in Pennsylvania this year to come give a speech and accept an award that is like to people of high moral character. People have shown themselves to be, you know, paragons of morality. So he's getting the love from charities and getting the money from charities, but apparently not giving it back.
Well, of course, paragons of morality should be rewarded. What did you call his headquarters office? What did they say?
Yeah, we tried to call his business, and their phone has been disconnected, so I couldn't get a hold of them. And I called this campaign, obviously, and the campaign said only one thing, which was Herschel Walker has given millions of dollars to charity. Full stop. You know, we asked, okay, well, tell us where, when, how, you know, did it comport with the promises he was making from his business? And it was just radio silence other than that one sentence.
Did they refer you to the website listofrandomnames.com?
No. You know, sadly, listofrandomnames.com is defunct. Whatever value it provided, it's not providing it anymore.
David Farenthold from the New York Times. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.